You are listening to Service Course by the Cycling Podcast with Lizzie Banks and Tom Whalley.
Well, Lizzie, I can see grey skies. They look like the same grey skies that I can see. Are you back in the country?
I am back in the country, but by the magic of podcasting, when you hear this, I will not be in the country. But yeah, I'm back in Sheffield. I've been here for a couple of weeks since we last spoke. I was in Girona, then I went to go and meet my team, Cerutis at WNT, for the first time in Valencia, which was really exciting. And we had a really productive week or so down there. And then, yeah, I came home for a couple of weeks before the start of the season this weekend in Omloop Het Nieuwsblad.
How are the cats? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, the cats, I have to say, they weren't very happy with me. They were pretty annoyed. I'd been away for such a long time. But, you know, they're all right now. And, well, I'm going again. And they don't know. So they're going to be annoyed again. But sorry, guys. But no, they're very happy that I'm home, which is the most important bit of the news roundup, to be honest.
Well, we'll talk more about Omloop at the end of the show because I want to ask you about your chances. And obviously, Rich has picked you out as a favourite, so I want to talk about that as well.
I hope he didn't put very much money on it.
Listen, I've got you as a favourite as well, Lizzie. But it's great to have you back in the country, only for a little bit, though. I've seen on Twitter your new bike, and it looks... Well, I mean, I've not ridden it or seen it in the flesh, but it looks really nice, Lizzie. It's a real looker. It's really nice.
It is a real looker. It's a really, really nice red and blue colour scheme, the same colour scheme as the Cerutis group. Orbea Orca OMX, a little bit of corrections corner here, because I said in the last episode that it was the Orbea Orca Aero. Actually, Kirsten and Veld is the only rider on the Orbea Orca Aero, and the rest of us are on the Orbea Orca OMX. But yeah, I mean, it's a pretty sick bike, to be honest. I've been riding it for, yeah, over a month now, and it just flies, and it goes downhill so fast. And I have to say, I just love having disc brakes. So, but yeah, you can head over to Twitter or Instagram if you want to see the new bike, or you can watch me on Saturday and you'll see all of our team riding it. But it's a beauty. It's a real beauty. And I think one of the most underrated things about bikes is the way that they look. And the performance benefit from feeling like you're riding a really cool looking bike. No, it looks great and it rides really, really well as well. So yeah, I'm pretty happy to be riding it this year.
Well, you mentioned disc brakes there. I want to pick up on that in a little bit. In the meantime, there's been a lot of cycling news around because there's cycling finally. One of the big things that's happened in the last month since we spoke is the UCI's ban on a couple of positions on the bike. So the Super Tuck, and I think, well, Carlton Kirby calls it the puppy paws when you drape them over the front of the front of the bike. I was quite pleased with these rule changes. I'm going to ask you how you feel about them in a minute. For me personally, the reason I was pleased is because I've been in amateur races where people have used those techniques and they've used them badly, and I've felt in danger because of it. So I'm quite happy that, you know, I mean, even though it's already been outlawed in amateur races for a long time, people wouldn't take action. What's your take on it? I mean, I don't know if you even use any of those positions at all.
I think it's a really tough one because, yeah, there's loads of things that you do in races that you don't do out of racing. Yeah, we ride on closed roads, so we ride on both sides of the road. I would never go around a blind corner on the wrong side of the road in training. I would always stick to my side in training. But in a race, it's different. And I think the argument for people, you know, like you, saying that we shouldn't, that it should be banned, is because people copy it. But people don't copy us and just go riding on the wrong side of the road and stuff. And if they do, then they're stupid. I mean, my opinion is that I have never, ever seen anyone crash because of it. And that there are, I mean, Kwiatkowski said the same thing as what I'm about to say exactly already. And it was exactly the same thought that I first had when I first saw it, that there are so many more important things to be doing. You know, even at La Course by the Tour de France, we were doing the recon and riding through the barriers. And I thought, you know, surely this isn't the same barrier setup for the men's race, because, you know, surely just this is just the bad barrier setup for the women's race and they'll have a good one for the men's race, because I couldn't believe how dangerous it was. It was a super fast run in and sprint along the seafront, and the barriers just kind of randomly went in and out, or they'd be going along and then they just kick in suddenly without noticing. And so what makes me super frustrated is we have these massive headlines and this big blanket ban on something where I have never once personally seen somebody crash from doing it. I actually can't really super tuck. I've got quite a long upper body and a relatively small frame size, so I don't fit on the frame. And I find that I don't need to. I just tuck down anyway. But sometimes I do drape my hands over the handlebars. But I've never crashed or even had any problem doing it. And I wouldn't do it in training. And I wouldn't do it in the middle of the bunch. I would only do it if I was kind of off the front on my own. So for me, I don't see the problem. And yeah, of course, you're always going to have people copying what the professionals do. And even if it's banned, people are still going to do it. I was on a training ride the other day, and because I've come back from abroad, I've just been riding alone or with my husband. And I was riding with my husband, and somebody jumped on our wheel going down a descent. Someone we didn't know, and I was going a bit quicker down the descent. He came onto his top tube next to my husband, and my husband was like, what are you doing? Don't crash me out. That's so stupid. And it was like 40 mile an hour sideways winds. So yeah, the UCI can ban it, but it's not going to stop people doing it necessarily. And I just don't really think that it's a massive issue in professional racing.
Well, it's interesting what you say there, Lizzie, because actually, you know, you talk about what's caused crashes. And I think, you know, in recent memory, the majority of, you know, crashes that have come about through positions on bikes seem to be when it's just people innocuously taking their hands off the handlebars. You know, I think that's what happened to Chris Froome, his big crash.
Yeah,
so do we ban that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Chris Froome's crash seemed like it was an innocuous crash that kind of happened out of nowhere, but he was going really fast downhill on his time trial bike and sat up, I think this is how he described it from what I read, sat up to kind of blow his nose and clear his nose, and then it was a freak accident then. Miguel Angel Lopez's crash on stage one of the Giro TT in 2020, he was going down a hill and then he was just moving from the bars to from the skis to the bars as he hit a pothole, and then he crashed. And the Trek rider, I've forgotten his name, who crashed just recently at the UAE Tour, he was just finishing his time trial and he was in the skis and nobody quite knows what happened. It looks like maybe there was a gust of the wind at the same point he hit a point of sand, a load of sand that was blowing across the road, and it kind of freak accident, and then he flew across the finish line and it was so dramatic. But yeah, so these are really, really terrible crashes, but please name me a rider that you've seen crashing from the super tuck position.
Well,
I can't think of one.
Not at all. I mean, that was Antonio Tiberi, wasn't it, the rider that had the crash at UAE Tour?
Yeah,
I've watched that video repeatedly trying to work out what happened there. I've got no idea. But we talked about Chris Froome, actually. So, I mean, Chris Froome has kind of dominated the sort of cycling news in the space between the last podcast and this one. Mainly because he's criticised his own bike. I mean, first of all, Lizzie, what does it take for a rider to publicly, I guess when you're Chris Froome, you can say whatever you like, but for a rider to publicly criticise their own equipment? That's a big step, right?
So to put this into context, we're talking about Chris Froome's YouTube review of his 2021 team bike with Israel Startup Nation, the Factor Austro Vam. And in it, he reviews the frame, and what it's like to move over to disc brakes. He said, yeah, if you want to stop, they stop in any conditions. And so it's super reliable. But what he doesn't like is the fact that he called it incessant rubbing of the discs, and the fact that when it's in the mechanic stand, it'll be fine, and then you'll get out onto the road and it starts rubbing. And he says he doesn't think the technology is where it needs to be yet, but that's the way the industry wants to go. And okay, I actually do agree with what he's saying. A lot of the time you do go out and you do get some rubbing on the disc brakes, and it can be a bit annoying. But I can't look away from the absolutely massive performance benefit of the fact that I can stop whenever I want. And I didn't quite realise how big a performance benefit this was, because I was riding in Girona and riding in Valencia and it's dry. You know, I had one day in 2 months when I rode in slightly wet conditions. And then since being home, you know, it's been wet, or the roads have been wet nearly every day. And because I'm riding roads that I've ridden time and time again, I know how I ride these roads. I know where I need to brake. I know how fast I can go down them. And suddenly I'm just you know, flying down these, I'm not taking any risks because I never do in training, and it's still relatively bad conditions because it's winter and there's stuff on the road and it's wet, but I'm just flying down these descents because I can just stop. And so for me, yes, I do think that we kind of need to look into a way that we can make disc brakes safer. We can look at potential covers for the rotors because it is a danger. You know, they do get very, very hot. And if it's going to, you know, if it comes into contact with your body, then it is just going to slice through your flesh. But I can't overlook the performance benefits of the fact that you can stop. So, yeah, I mean, I'd say a bold move calling it out, but I don't think, you know, I think it's fine what he said.
So in terms of criticising your own equipment, Lizzie, what status do you need to be as a rider to do it?
Like, greatest of all time, I think.
I mean, listen, I'm not suggesting you've got any problems with your equipment or anything like that, but, you know, what would it take for you to sort of, you know, if you'd done the same thing, for instance, as Froome, like done a YouTube and talked about your new bike and criticised the disc brakes on it or something like that. What would have happened? What would be the consequence?
I don't know, but I think I would say personally, I would never recommend something that I don't genuinely believe in. So I think if it's a product that I have to use that I don't really rate, I would just avoid talking about it. You know, you kind of block and bridge that question rather than saying, yeah, I think it's great when it's not. And of course, there will always be times when professional athletes, there are circumstances when you have to use something that maybe isn't the best thing for you. But yeah, there are ways around it. And also, you know, companies also want to work with athletes in order to make new products. You know, companies aren't just happy with what they've got, because if they were, then we would never progress. And, you know, with disc brakes, especially one of the problems with disc brakes is that there is a weight disadvantage. And so that's something that I know Orbea are looking into. They want to try and bring down the weight of the frame because disc brake bikes are heavier than normal bikes, right?
Apparently so, Lizzie.
Wrong. Well, I followed G Milner, who is the creator of the Dream Build series on YouTube, where they basically just get a load of really sick bikes and components and do really cool videos of them being built up. He built up a sub-5 kilo disc brake road bike with fully functioning group set, everything you would want, two rings at the front, full group set at the back, for less than 5 kilos. How is that possible? Anyway, I didn't quite know how it was possible, so I got in touch with him and I asked him to run us through the exact makeup of the bike and tell us how he did it.
Okay, so it's based around the Specialized AFOS frame set, which is arguably like the lightest disc ready frame that you can purchase on the market today. And we built it up with a mixture of components because it wasn't a stock bike, so we could kind of pick and choose. And we worked with companies, you know, they're really well known for their lightweight and reliability. So we chose a seat post from Darimo alongside a bar and stem from them. And they're a Spanish company. I can't quote the exact weights off the top of my head, but it was pretty mental. Actually, I can. I've got an email. So the seat post is 83 grams and the bar and stem 196 grams like together, which is pretty mental. For the group set, we chose the DI2 Shimano Durace. It's not massively lighter than SRAM, but it is lighter, so it's, you know, at the end of the day, we might as well use that. And then we chose a carbon crank set, but we didn't get any support from the crank set company, so I'm not going to say anything. But it was pretty light, but we could have gone lighter as well. Like, we could have chosen, you know, a few extra bits of posh carbon, which went with that. You know, but, and then the other thing as well, so we used AX Lightness saddle, which is ridiculous. And also an AX Lightness wheel set, which was modified by Zed Bike Wheels. And he actually strung them with string spokes. So that dropped the weight by, I think it was like 100 gram a wheel or something. But it's everything on it. Like, what we wanted to do, we could have gone lighter. And, you know, that's perfectly easy to go a few hundred grams lighter, but at the end of the day, we wanted to create a bike which wasn't just a sort of a piece that you just post the photo online and then everyone says it's cool and then that's it. Like, we want it to be able to be a bike that can be ridden and, you know, you can trust it. And especially when we've had light bikes in the past, you get on them and you think, oh, this feels quite frail. Whereas as soon as we built this up, we just had a sit on it and it's like, it feels really solid. Like, it doesn't feel frail. And it's kind of, I guess it's the ideal bike to essentially for, you know, people like Rick, the mechanic who loves going up hills, and it's people to sort of go out. You know, I can't imagine how good it is in the Alps because you've got 160mm rotors with hydraulic discs and a bike that weighs less than 5 kilos. Like, it's just going to be insane. So it's a bike that's rideable and usable, but it's also pushing the boundaries of weight whilst not just being a sort of poster piece, really. So the final weight of the bike came to 4.94 kilos. And that includes road racing tubs as well. So road tubs from Pirelli. And we're just working on the video at the moment in terms of the editing, but we're trying to add the weights to every item that goes on. Like, we weighed every single item that goes on so that people know that it's not just a fake weight at the end. So it's just taking a bit of extra time, but obviously once it's done, it'll all be on the Dreambuild channel. And yeah, we'll hopefully we're doing a riding project as well, so people can see that it's actually rideable.
That's really cool. Unfortunately, you can't race it yet because it's 2 kilos too light.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, I guess that's what Specialized said when they, you know, they launched it and people were asking, because it does have a UCI sticker on it, and people are like, well, what's the point if you were never going to give it to the race team? And I guess for them, they can make a tarmac as light, you know, to the legal limit for the weight limit. So it's until that weight limit, you know, decreases, and, you know, the bike's never going to get raced in, you know, traditional format. But I guess for hill climbs and, you know, even just like, say, if people wanting to do mega rides and do some Strava segments, you know, it's kind of ideal because a lot of the hill climb bikes that people enter, like, they're one trick ponies, aren't they? You can't descend on them, and they're terrifying to even ascend on. So it's interesting to see what people do with this platform. And, you know, now you have a bike that you can, you know, ride it in the absolute pissing rain, and it's still really, you know, still high performance in terms of the braking and whatnot. So yeah, I guess it's interesting to see what happens with.
In terms of the UCI as well, I think, you know, that rule's been there for a long time in terms of safety. And once you start to get somebody to push the boundary and to say, look, we can do this safely and it's real world rideable, and we've got the safety factor there, you can go uphill fast, you can also go downhill and you can stop, then you start proving these things to the UCI. And then once there's kind of enough evidence, then that's maybe when they start to change as well. So you've got to have somebody to start to push the boundary if you want to make change.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think the rule was brought in a long time ago, and it kind of needed to. It was just as, I guess, carbon was becoming, you know, we've been obviously carbons, you know, people have been aware of carbon fiber for a long time, but a lot of bike design was happening and people were just making quite dangerous products that, you know, they were just pushing the weight boundary as much as possible and not really dealing with consequences that could, you know, come about it. But I think in a position where we're at now, you know, we get so many interesting and quirky components coming through, and there's a lot of, I guess you can call them underground manufacturers, you know, maybe not the mainstream guys that are producing, you know, like a lot of the brands that are featured on this bike, they're producing incredible components that you pick them up and you're just like, how is, you know, it's one of those things where your arm moves up further than it should because you just anticipate there's going to be heavier. You know, even this frame set now is just insane when you're like, you can hold it with a single finger, like your little finger. I lifted it on my little finger and it's just, but it feels really stiff. And it, you know, the carbon, you on some frames you can squeeze the carbon, which is quite daunting, but on this it's like, it's so robust, and it does make you think, you know, how long is it going to be before the UCI do decide that, you know, that weight limit is sort of, you know, well in the past, and people can produce things a lot better now.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please. Well, that said, PK, the voice of Race Radio at the Tour de France, interrupting Service Course, and indeed me, Richard Moore, interrupting Service Course, or replacing Tom Wally briefly, because I'm with Lizzie. Hello, Lizzie.
Hello, Richard. Nice to have you here.
And I'm here to remind you that this month's episode is sponsored by Babbel. Now, Babbel is the foreign language learning app which I use pretty religiously, because I have to learn French. I have to be better at speaking French, and I find it pretty effective, and I enjoy it as well. And Lizzie, you are a frustrated Italian speaker, or a learning Italian speaker. You've used Babbel. How do you find it?
I would love to say I'm an Italian scholar, but I think that would say that my Italian is a little better than it is. But I've been using Babbel to help me improve my Italian. I can use it on my phone, which is really great. And I love using it when I'm traveling to kind of pass those hours between when you're traveling from one race to the next. And the thing I love about it is that it's really conversational. So instead of just learning Italian words that I would never use, I learn phrases that are really, really useful to me in day-to-day life and help me actually get by when I'm in Italy.
Absolutely. I find that I learn the little connecting words almost and start to recognize them in conversation as well from Babbel. It's a really effective way of learning, I think. And as I said, it is fun as well. It teaches real life conversations, as you say, and you learn through interactive dialogue, speech recognition technology. So it's difficult in public place, isn't it? Although there aren't many public places at the moment. Lessons are lovingly created by over 100 language experts, real people, and not by machines. So you learn useful vocabulary and not meaningless phrases. Babbel's recently launched their own learning podcast, so you can brush up on your Spanish or French while cooking or exercising. And with Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. The teaching method has been proven to be effective across multiple studies. And it's available as an app or online. And as you progress, your progress will be synced across all devices. Right now, Babbel is offering our listeners 6 months free with a purchase of a six-month subscription using the promo code CYCLE. Go to babbel.co.uk/play and use the promo code CYCLE on your six-month subscription. That's babbel.co.uk/play. Promo code CYCLE.
So I think, Lizzie, when it comes to you winning the National Hill Climb competition, you need G Milner in your corner, I reckon.
Yeah, I hope he doesn't sell off that bike before then. But is this the National Hill Climb at Winnetts that I just happen to have a couple of other engagements on that day for already?
Okay, well, we'll move on from that. Lizzie, I'm going to talk to you at the end of the show, like I said, about the opening weekend, Strade Bianche, the upcoming races, because I really want to know how you're feeling going into them, and I want to, you know, find out about your chances and stuff like that and what you're thinking. But let's get on with the episode. So the main thing for this week is I have been, well, since lockdown, and probably more because of having children, I have done very, very little outdoor riding over the last, well, effectively the last year, which has meant I've sort of leaned more into the world of Zwift, of RGT, of Trainer Road particularly. And it's, I mean, obviously all of us are cyclists these days. Pretty much, I imagine everybody listening to this is either used Zwift or an equivalent. So I've been fascinated by the way that cycling has moved online. So this, indulge me, this whole next piece is all about online cycling and essentially cycling and video games.
There is an incompleteness in transplanting a sport into a virtual world. Thus, you add in game mechanics which help you tell a better story with it. Power-ups, live data, challenging courses. There is an incompleteness to watching a bike race from afar, and thus you add in commentary, facts, figures, and the season-to-season storylines of the rise and fall of heroes, villains, champions, and plucky underdogs. Surprised by the eagerness of my spectators as I streamed my races on Zwift, I struck on a useful storytelling term for exploring how the different modes of experience make thrilling their incompleteness. Dramatic irony.
That was Hannah Nicklin reading from her essay Dramatic Irony, Zwift and Racing Under Lockdown, and we'll hear more from her later. For now, please indulge me. There are two things in life that I really love: cycling and video games. Yeah, there's music and film too, and oh yeah, my family. But we can leave them to one side for now and just sit in that sweet spot of the Venn diagram where video games and cycling meet. I'm not sure if you yourself are a fan of video games, but you're most likely male and over 30, so I'm pretty sure you'll have some experience of them. At the very least, I'm almost certain that you use Zwift, and if that's not a video game, then I don't know what is. Actually, that question about whether Zwift is a game or a sport looms large in this episode.
One of the most boring questions you can ask about Zwift is it a game or is it sport? Because essentially, if you go to the experts, everyone starts going, well, you know, performance, play, sport, games, they're all a kind of ritual. and they are, like, they actually all have in common this idea that they are not work. There's a lot of academics in game design, but also people analyzing performance and sport and games as a similar human activity. All of them would describe them as a kind of not work. They are outside of reality. Well, they are reality, but you draw a circle around it. Johan Huizinga calls it like the magic circle of play or games. And in that circle, different rules apply. And the idea is that you voluntarily subscribe to rules that you choose to work to. So the spaces between game, play, and sport are actually, and performance as well, are actually really thin.
Talking of Zwift, you may have taken part in one of our cycling podcast non-drop cappuccino rides. While they're happening, a few of us from the podcast are normally chatting away on Discord, and we often chat about video games, especially if Rob Hatch is around. Rob will always find a way to reference the 90s Amiga classic, The Secret of Monkey Island.
You fight like a dairy farmer.
How appropriate, you fight like a cow. In this episode, I'm going to explore the ways that cycling and video games have overlapped and how we've come to be where we are now, where platforms like Zwift, RGT, Trainer Road and others have become ubiquitous. We'll hear from Wes Salmon, the lead game designer at Zwift, Hannah Nicklin, herself a competitive cyclist and CEO of the De Guta Fabriek game studio, Mike Rose from video game publishers No More Robots, and Marcus Cheek, the man behind Hustle City, a cycle messenger-based game that utilises your turbo trainer and your phone. We're going to start, though, back in the 1980s. That was when I first got into cycling and video games. Growing up in Nottingham in the shadow of the Rally Factory and during the beginnings of the BMX craze, you couldn't really escape cycling. And it felt like every kid had a Rally Banana jersey knocking around or that replica yellow jersey with Kellogg's on it. I've no idea what that was actually from. This was the time when Britain's premier race was the Milk Race. And it was Milk Race that was the first cycling game I can remember playing. A few years ago, I started a YouTube channel called Playing Cycling Video Games with Cyclists. If you haven't seen it, don't bother. And I have the Commodore 64 version of the game on cassette right here. I bought it with the full intention of doing an episode about it before life got too busy and I paused my YouTube career. I might bring it back soon. We'll see. One of the things I wanted to do when putting together this edition of Service Course was to speak to someone involved in the making of that game. And I managed to find someone.
It's an odd story. My first job was at Cheltenham Borough Council in the planning department.
This is Stuart Rucroft.
There was an advert in the local paper for a programmer, a ZX81 programmer with a company called Fantasy Software. And they were literally 100 metres from the office where I was working. I could see them out the window. And I just called in. They were looking at the bottom of the advert. There was a sort of sub pattern of basically a bit of subtext asking for graphic artists and sound designers or sound engineers. And I just called in and they showed me what they did. It was all done on paper at the time. Basically, they would draw the shape on a 64 pixel set of grids. So it's basically one area on the screen was 64 by 64. They would fill it in with a pencil and then they would code it by hand. And then they would feed that code into the machine.
Stuart worked on a whole bunch of games in the 1980s.
For Fantasy Software, we worked on Beaky and the Egg Snatchers, Backpacker's Guide to the Galaxy, Pyramid 2 there. Then I worked for Design Design in Manchester. We worked on 2012 on that and a game called On the Run. And I worked for Orpheus Software in Cambridge. We did 2JAD and the Young Ones, which was a complete failure. I was involved in Global Software, so we did like Curse of the Mushroom People. And then it was extended into mostly Konami games, which was sort of just mentioned. Nemesis, Salamander, Green Beret, Iron Horse, Jailbreak I did. I like Jailbreak. I really enjoyed that game. And then we did some things, a few track and field games.
It was fascinating for me chatting with Stuart about the world of video games in the 80s. But what could he tell me about Milk Race? Sadly, very little.
I used to just get phone calls about, can you do a loading screen quick? Or can you do graphics? Or can you do the background something? And it was constant. I was in such demand. Sometimes I was working on maybe 4 games a day, once in a day. When I was working for Konami, there was at least 2 other games for other companies that I was working on. And that's probably why I can't remember. I was looking it up this morning. There was other games that I actually did bits and pieces and graphics for. And sometimes I never used to do the whole suite. And the Oliverton twins did they did BMX simulators. I wouldn't be surprised if the actual artwork was hacked and repurposed for the Milk Race or something like that, which is why I can't remember doing it.
Now, I began this dive into the world where video games and cycling interact with Hannah Nicklin reading an extract from her essay, Dramatic Irony, Zwift and Racing Under Lockdown. Hannah first came to my attention with her N+1 zine.
It's a really silly thing, which you can buy online at the cost of £1.50 if you want a digital version of it. There was a limited run of print versions of it, and it actually came out of a hyper talk, they're called, a short talk that I did at a games festival in Berlin called Amaze, who sort of focus on the fringes of experimental video games and indie games. It's just a running joke that I used to sit in my old flat in London with my housemate Pat while he played video games, and I would be like working away on my laptop, and I would just criticize the bikes in them. I'd be like, this is why they've just recolored the same model of bike and like repeat and copy and pasted it like 50 times through this scene. And he's like, Hannah, it's not about the bike. I was like, if you can hit someone with the bike, then I want to see more than one model of bike, essentially. And so this running joke, I was pitching things to Amaze and they have this hyper talk session. And as I said, I come from like a theater background. I'm quite used to performing. And I just thought that it might be nice to do a little like comedy performance talk, essentially, of me taking far too seriously the quality and experience of bikes in video games, where the bike isn't central to the video game. But actually, I think some of the best experiences of bikes in video games are really where they capture just the joy of traveling on a bike. Like, for example, one of the highest scoring, because I marked them out of 10, one of the highest scoring video game experiences of a bike is a tiny, tiny, tiny game by a collective based out of the Netherlands, I think, called Sock Pop. But they made this really lovely game called Duck Playground, I think. And you can, as a duck, run around, find a bike, get on the bike and ride around. It's a little fixie bike and your little duck legs spin. But something that it gets about the joy of playing around on a bicycle is much more true to life than many experiences. Although shout out to GTA, who do pretty fun things with bikes as well.
When I'm not on the turbo trainer doing what Trainer Road tells me to do, I'm probably playing video games. I'm currently working my way through Deus Ex: Mankind Revisited, which features a whole bunch of futuristic-looking bikes propped up against walls in a dystopian future Prague. Something Hannah would have loved when she was creating N+1. Mm-hmm. Hannah's got serious cycling and video game credentials. She's raced at a national level here in the UK. And, as I mentioned earlier, she runs the Deguta Fabriek game studio in Copenhagen. She's also far, far, far smarter than me, as you can gauge from some of our conversation.
We, the audience, know that Hamlet's dad was killed by his new dad, for example. But Hamlet doesn't know it yet. That's dramatic irony. It's about an imbalance of knowledge. And I think that all the different aspects of bike racing can be looked at through this lens of the balance of stories and data and bodies. So when you're in Zwift, you may have less access to that embodied presence of others, but you raise the amount of data overview that you have. You can see their data in a way that you can't, and people can't bluff with you in the same way. So you raise that knowledge. And when you're experiencing it yourself, you have a particular storied experience of it because you're like, I know this username. I don't know them in real life, yeah, but they beat me the last three time trials I did. And this time I'm just going to stick to them like glue and get them in the end. So you build your own storied experience of it. Equally, if we watch like the brilliant Rob Hatch commentating on some live cycling, you don't have the embodied experience. You have some overview of data, but what really brings it to life is the commentating. It's the commentary, rather. It's the stories that they tell. It's the fact that you know about the half a decade long rivalry between these particular cyclists, or you know that this cyclist is a particular cyclist's son, and there's a history in his family. Or you know that Marianne Vos has come back after, you know, suffering from post-viral syndrome or like just exhaustion. You know that she has come back from that and everything that she's achieved, and that she still cares about this win. Like, these are the stories which make that feel real. And then finally, equally, when you attend a cycling event, but you're not doing it, you're not in the high-speed, high-stakes chess game of actually cycling, you're on the sidelines watching, then you lean into the bodied experience, right? You're there, you're present, you're getting drunk on Dutch Corner. You know, it took you 2 days camping to make sure that you staked your spot. And then they go by in the rush of let's say it's a climb and it takes them a minute to pass you by. They're gone. But what you have is the community around it. You have the story of the community, the presence, and the thrill of just, you know, seeing some of your heroes go by. So all cycling, as I sort of go into in the essay, is a balance between stories, data, and bodies. And I think when it's most successful, it's getting that balance right in one direction or another. And if you can't add in bodies, like in Zwift, then you have to add in data. You have to find the ways to compensate in the area, in a different area, if you can't add in that particular ingredient.
That brings us to where we currently are in the world of cycling and video games, a point where hardware and software have combined to give us platforms like Zwift. As it has been to Hannah, Zwift, and for me particularly, Trainer Road, have been genuine lifelines during the repeated lockdowns of 2020 and 2021. And I couldn't imagine doing an episode on cycling and video games without speaking to someone from one of the big online cycling platforms.
My name is Wes Salmon, and I'm a lead game designer at Zwift. We've been lucky to be able to provide something that people can really use during the pandemic and lockdowns to kind of find that freedom of riding a bike without having to go outside, or if they can't go outside. It's a blessing and a curse. Like, ultimately, we would want people to be able to ride outside because we all know it's amazing. But when you can't, if they have Zwift, it's great. I was living in Seattle, working for Microsoft at the time, and I had basically created a model of riding my bike every single day, regardless of the weather, regardless of the situation. I basically got rid of my car, would ride my bike to work every single day. Riding in the constant misty rain was just a fact of life for me. And I did that for a couple years, and I built up the kind of the hard man syndrome. It was like, yeah, there's no weather that's going to stop me from riding. But ultimately, it gets tiresome. You know, you want to actually ride in good weather when you can. But then I found on DC Rainmaker's site, the Zwift beta, where he was talking about how this new game was coming out and was going to actually, you know, give people with indoor trainers something better to do than watch Netflix. And I didn't even have a trainer at the time because, again, I'm an always outdoor kind of guy. So at some point during the process, I decided I wanted to try indoor. So I went to REI, I went and got a Wahoo kicker, and I got a Alienware computer to run it on, and I got into the Zwift beta and instantly fell in love with it. It was one of those perfect storm of situations where I logged in and there were other people that were interested in talking with me, not just riding around me, but chatting and actually having a conversation while we rode. So we jumped on TeamSpeak, which was the voice chat of the time. And I was instantly riding with someone from Canada, from London, from North Carolina. And I was like, this is amazing, because as a gamer, like that's really what tickles me, is when I can get on World of Warcraft and be playing video games with all these people from all around the world that I would never meet otherwise. Now I was able to take that and combine it with the cycling. Oh, it was a dream. It was amazing. So I would come home and basically find a way to like ride to work, but like ride easy. It's like a race Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays in Zwift, because I had to figure out a way to make sure I could continue to Zwift. And it carried on through the winter. And then when the spring and summer came around, which is the best time to ride in Seattle, I found myself wanting to actually save my legs for Zwift rides. I'd be in my garage, I'd open the garage up, and it'd be a beautiful day out, but I'd be in Zwift. So from then, I tried to find ways to kind of like convert my Microsoft career into more of a career that let me do something in cycling and gaming.
I want to talk now about sort of Zwift as the world inside of Zwift that you've been able to create. And I think one of the interesting things for me is that, you know, Zwift is a virtual world, but the way people talk about it, it feels really real. And do you get that?
I do, for sure. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that we've taken some real world landmarks and made worlds around them so that people can basically say, oh yeah, I can see myself riding through Richmond. I can see myself riding through London, even if I've never been there. But then you take Watopia and you basically create this, you know, mega map with all of these different biomes that people enjoy and start to really love and find their favorites. Once you have something that's a favorite, it's real to you, even if it's completely fictional.
It's interesting. And, so, and obviously, you know, you've created this virtual world. And because it's a virtual world, you know, it's unlimited. You can do whatever you want with it. Obviously, it's rooted in reality. Is there a sort of tension between the things that you could possibly do and keeping it rooted in that reality?
There oftentimes is. And one of the things we try to do with Watopia versus the other worlds that we've released is we try to keep the worlds that are based on real world locations more grounded than Watopia. So you'll see things in Watopia that you would never see in London or in Yorkshire. And Watopia is kind of our playground, but we do try to make it feel like cycling and running. We don't put you on jet bikes and we don't do crazy stuff like that, but theoretically we could. And if we did that, we would do that in Watopia. You probably wouldn't see that in one of the real world locations we have in the game.
One of the things that has fascinated me about Zwift and its growth has been the way in which it has been able to incorporate video game language and combine it with the feeling of a sport. By that, I mean that the effort is physical, but with things like power-ups, Zwift speaks to those of us who have grown up playing video games.
What is successful about Zwift is that they have found means to lean into the fact that they've had to simplify some real-life mechanics of competitive cycling. Because they've had to simplify them, they have increased the visualization and just made the screen full of things that you can choose to concentrate on. Meaning, crucially, that it's possible to miss things. Like, I think part of the drama of racing in Zwift is that there's quite a lot for you to be paying attention to. And so it's not foolproof. You can be paying attention to data, but then not notice that someone's used a power-up, right? The tension between those things helps keep it alive and interesting. And then additionally, on top of that, the simple use of extremely simple game mechanic concepts like a power-up enables them to just, again, bring it to life and to find ways of compensating for the things that you lose in taking it online.
So online platforms like Zwift seem to have really nailed the cycling experience. But the history of cycling in video games is patchy, to say the least. Off the top of my head, there have been games like Paperboy, California Games, Matt Hoffman BMX, Grand Theft Auto, that have attempted to capture the experience of riding a bike, and obviously doing so in a world where they are limited by the technology of the time. I have to say that Grand Theft Auto does cycling very, very well.
What's ironic about the Grand Theft Auto one is that it was never really intended to actually have cycling in the game in a meaningful way, and they knocked it out of the park. Like, riding a bike in Grand Theft Auto is hilariously fun.
Yeah, of course, you know, everybody played GTA, especially San Andreas.
This is Mike from No More Robots. More from him later.
And rode around on those bikes. The physics were not fantastic looking back, but at the time, riding around on a bike in GTA felt amazing.
But cycling titles are not common in video gaming, especially road cycling games. There is, of course, Pro Cycling Manager, but I'm not a fan, as you'll learn from my YouTube review of it.
After I completed the training, I moved on to another part of the game that you can play. I was still waiting for the update that would let me play the Tour de France, which is what I want to do. But one of the things you can do is you can have a go at descending and test yourself on various different descents. I would describe that as moderately exciting. You'll notice that although I'm appalling at descending, it is actually impossible to crash.
One of the other games that I really love is a game called Descenders, which is a mountain bike game where you're doing all kinds of cool tricks off of these big kicker ramps, things I could never do in real life. But visually it's beautiful. That's a great game. I would recommend anyone who plays any kind of games, check out Descenders.
I said there would be more from Mike later. Well, he's part of the team behind Descenders, so let's hear from him now.
I think one of the core things from very early on was it going to be an arcade-y style game, or was it going to be more of a simulation? Was it going to really try to capture what it was like riding a bike, or was it going to be more video gamey? Was it going to be, you know, silly jumps and all this kind of stuff? And through a lot of experimentation, it ended up falling somewhere in between. The problem that we found with creating a simulation was that actually, in the end, sometimes simulations just aren't very fun. You know, if you go off a jump slightly too big, you know, in real life, you get hurt. And in a video game, you want to go off a big jump at a silly speed sometimes. You know, that's just what you want to do. It's a game. You want to be able to break from you want to be able to break from real life a little bit. But we did still want to appeal with the game in such a way that people didn't feel like it was, you were riding a magic bike, you know, you were like zipping into the air and you could land anything. So you definitely do, the bike definitely feels real to ride, especially if you play the game in first person. You know, we get a lot of people telling us that it really does feel to them at times like they're really riding a bike, just without the bruises. It was definitely trying to capture why it feels nice to ride a bike, but try to inject as much sort of game into it as we possibly could without alienating anybody who wanted to ride a bike in a game, essentially.
Now, we are at this point in time where online cycling is a thing that feels very much like it is here to stay. I've been wondering about where platforms like Zwift and RGT may go next and what new platforms might spring up.
Well, I'm a huge fan of New York. I love what we did with New York. We were bound by some of the constraints around the park, and we were bound by some of the systems that we had in place for how we could have multiple elevations in that small plot of land. But I love the idea of being able to ride through a real cityscape like New York in a way that, you know, reminds me of some of the cycling movies from the 80s and 90s where I can pretend like I'm a bike messenger. Like those kind of things, those kind of gamifications of me pedaling a bike where I can still see on screen that this person's like dodging between cars, and I'm literally not dodging between cars on my trainer, but I'm putting the power down. I'm deciding when we slow up or speed or slow down or speed up. So I'm part of it. Like those kind of games are super fun to me. So like if I could do anything, I would go and try to find ways to make New York or some cityscape a way for people to like just like feel like they're closer to the grit of like old school cycling.
You know what, you've really touched on something there. I was thinking now, if you could sort of emulate Premium Rush or Breaking Away
exactly
in the game, oh mate, I would be so sold on that. That would be incredible. Yeah. I would love to see that.
I like to ride fixed gear, No brakes. Can't stop. Don't want to either.
We got him.
If you haven't seen Premium Rush, it came out, I think, in 2012, and it stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a cycle messenger in New York. Despite being on a fixed gear, he easily outruns riders on the latest road bikes, but strangely seems to struggle to get away from a bicycle policeman on a hybrid. You don't need to see it.
You know how sexy you are when you talk like that? I'll call you when I deliver.
Now, I was half joking when I mentioned to Wes that I wanted to play Premium Rush, the game. But then I heard about Hustle City. A new entry to the online cycling market. Hustle City, like Soul Cycling, a game that utilises your turbo as you guide your avatar around the surface of Mars delivering cargo. In Hustle City, you are the equivalent to Joseph Gordon-Levitt in Premium Rush, as you ride around a city, avoiding cars and delivering packages. It's the logical next step in online cycling, and I spoke to Marcus Cheek, one of the men behind it.
Honestly, the way that I like to think about it is that Hustle City is the most fun you can have riding indoors. Of course, it's a cycling exercise game for your smart trainer, but it's story driven. And I think that is, like, as I've mentioned, to me, stories are important, but it's like a powerful differentiator that I think creates a lot of opportunities. So we wrap all of the like challenges and tasks that you have to do within Hustle City in the story. The story is the backdrop and the motivator for your workout, right? And so, you know, we believe that fun can actually be a huge motivator beyond, you know, external targets like power numbers, you know, or peer pressure from other players around you. And that really, it just turns into something that's fun first. It's about like play and exploration. So the game is currently in an invite-only beta. If you want to get on the beta, basically just go to ridehustlecity.com. You fill out your email. We follow up with like a quick application and survey. We're really looking for people that are genuinely interested by what they see, and it's something that they feel is for them, because the whole idea of the beta and the beta testers is to build this game and to develop it alongside people so that it's right for the players. Because it's so new in a variety of ways, we need to know like what's working, you know, what's making it fun, and then also what's frustrating folks, so that we can start to balance that and really get it to just like hit the spot. The idea is this beta is like the pilot episode, and we like to think of Hustle City as kind of like a TV series. That's the way we're building the structure. And so this is episode one, season one, introducing you to Hustle City, to Will Baldwin, to the whole world. And from there, we have 5 episodes planned for season one, which continue to develop on the you know the gameplay, but then also like build out Will's story as he, you know, starts as a novice bike messenger. And you might have seen in some of the like video out there as he makes his way to become the greatest cyclist of a generation. You know, so this is the start of his story. And we're just kind of taking it from there. It's surprising when I hear folks play the game and they're like, wow, that was amazing. Like, that was like, you know, 20 minutes, right? It was so fun. And I'm like, no, that was actually like about 40 minutes, you know? And they're like, whoa, no way. And so I think it's the combination of, you know, the like micro missions and the fact that you don't really know what's coming next. And it's just unfolding as it is for Will Baldwin, that that helps people, you know, take their mind off what they're doing and just, you know, push it.
Hustle City is currently, at the time of publishing this episode, in beta mode. If you want to get involved, then go to ridehustlecity.com. To end this little meander through the world of cycling and video games, I thought we'd attempt to answer the question of whether Zwift and its equivalents are a game or a sport. Here, once more, are some people who are much smarter than me.
One of the things that I like to say when I'm lecturing is that theatre is a game so old we forgot it's a game, but it has very clear rules. Like, we all pretend that those people are people and that they can't see us, right? That there's a really simple rule set, and it's, you know, equally sport, which certainly has definitions set out by, like, you know, the Olympic Commission and people like that. But it's all made up. Those definitions are made up. The idea that sport should, so in 1992, the Council of Europe had like a kind of published something that defined sport, which is very often now referred to by different sporting bodies around the world as something which is aimed at expressing or improving physical fitness and mental well-being, forming social relationships, or obtaining results in competition at all levels, right? I don't think that excludes esports. I really don't. And I certainly see the point of, like, physical esports, esports, and sports being, you know, different places on the same spectrum. But the key thing is that it is a spectrum. So to get to your question around, like, Zwift and the game elements in it, cycling, bike racing, is already something that has a rule set. It has what you might even call real world mechanics, in that you have to interact with it on a bike, right? That is the main mechanic through which you interact with bike racing. Another mechanic might be the absence or presence of race radios. Another real life bike racing mechanic might be teams and teamwork. Equally on Zwift, there are some things which translate directly from the game of professional cycling, or from competitive cycling, probably better to say. That includes things like the demands of a course. That includes things like drafting, power to weight ratios. But those things are necessarily simplified, right? Because there are so many other humane bodily things involved, like whether or not someone looks like they're suffering in the real world, right? If someone looks like they're suffering, you're like, I know I can attack right now. But in the world of, like, plain-faced avatars, you instead have to replace that with visualizing data and, you know, turning the data a different color if someone's attacking. That kind of, the addition of that mechanic makes up for what is missing from the bodily experience. And I would say that the main distinction, which is not just about kind of subbing for something that already existed in terms of game mechanics in Zwift, is the power-ups. And I think what is most, like, quote-unquote successful about them is that they exploit an already used and understood vocabulary from video games. And it's the most video gamey thing, which is everyone says, like Mario Kart when describing them, right? Essentially. Yeah. And it exploits the existing mechanics of, like, of draft, of aero, right? Of drag coefficients and power to weight. Like, it's exploiting things from cycling, but using the game design vocabulary that is pretty well established in a generation now who probably all grew up playing Mario Kart.
Part of the struggle is, how do you take something where the main input is your physical effort and call it just a game? Because it's not. Like, it's not like you've got a keypad and you're just, you know, using your thumbs, which is also somewhat sporting if you think about skill and agility. But from a pure athletic standpoint, the way you interact with Zwift right now is much more a sport than it is a game. But what we do is we try to wrap around that sporting endeavor the gamification of riding indoors, because we all know riding indoors can be a chore. And one of the things we've been striving to do is make it something you look forward to, not something you dread.
So there you go. And if I do see any of you cycling in cyberspace, then please give me a ride on. I need the points because I've got my eye on some new kit.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, that's me just finishing off a Science in Sport Rego. I've just done 90 minutes on the turbo, and honestly, I just absolutely rinse through this stuff. I'm one of those guys, actually, you know, when I like a product, I very rarely switch. I'm the sort of guy who goes to a restaurant and orders the same thing every time. That's me. But Science and Sport do a phenomenal range of products, and you should check them out. Not quite the pudding-flavoured gel yet that Lionel requested, but maybe that's in the works. If you want to get 25% off your next order with Science and Sport, then go to scienceinsport.com and just enter the offer code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Lizzie, favourite cycling video game? Have you got one?
I can't say I've used many cycling video games or many video games at all. I think my video game history includes Sonic the Hedgehog on the Sega Mega Drive, and the original PC version of GTA, one before San Andreas. What was it called?
Vice City.
Yeah, that one, where you had to go and rob cars and throw flamethrowers at people and things like that. But listening to that, maybe I'm more into video games than I thought. You know, that immersive experience of Zwift, I guess you don't really think of it as a video game, but that's why you get hooked. And I... you know, a lot of people listening to this will think, why do you always talk about Zwift? But it's because it's the big one, you know? I went on there the other day and there was 14,000 people Zwifting, and it's really incredible the way it's grown. But there are so many other platforms as well. And it's really cool to see the way it's growing. There's Ruby, there's Beacle, Trainer Road, like you said, Sufferfest. Oh, just to mention a few, RGT, you know, loads and loads. And it's a really exciting movement. We've got esports teams as well. And so, yeah, I think it's really cool that it's growing. And at the beginning, I think a lot of people criticized it. And the same way with e-bikes, people criticize it. But why? You know, if it gets people exercising, if it gets people on their bikes, the more that we can do to get people exercising, the better, in my opinion.
Well, honestly, like I said, as I said in that piece, I'm particularly excited about the sort of the more gamey platforms that are emerging, like Sol and Hustle City, and the potential for those over the next few years. But Lizzie, you're going to do some actual outdoor riding starting this weekend. It is Omloop. It is opening weekend. It's genuinely opening weekend for you guys, because none of you have really hit out yet in the women's peloton.
Yeah, the only races that have happened this year so far have been the Australian National Championships and what was the Santos Tour Down Under that got rebranded as the Santos Festival of Cycling. So a few of the Aussies have raced. There's been the Kiwi National Championships as well, but none of the kind of European-based riders have raced yet. So it's really exciting. And this year at Omloop, I think sometimes you at Omloop, you know, you see riders, some riders who are kind of saving themselves for Strada and starting the weekend after. But I think as a hangover from last year and that kind of thing when we don't know when we're going to get more races or if all the races are going to get cancelled suddenly. I've not seen the full start list for Omloop yet, but I've seen the number of riders who are saying, yeah, hands up, I'm going to be there. And it is going to be one hell of a start list. And so it's going to be one hell of a fight. And weirdly, the forecast says sunshine, which is a bit of a shame. But I think it's going to be a battle royale, an incredible race to watch, because there's going to be so many people fighting out there. So make sure you tune in.
I was going to say, obviously, last year, you know, Omloop, when you were sixth, I don't know if you'd gone into that race with it as a target. And I wonder if how well you performed last time out has sort of changed the way you view that race, whether it's more of a goal for you.
I think everything that happened last year has changed the way I view the races now. For sure, last year, actually, I had a bit of a knee injury when I went into Omloop last year. I'd crashed in the Setmana Valenciana race and on the first day and had a niggling knee thing that I raced through to help my team, kind of thing that I usually do, which maybe I shouldn't have done. And then I got home and I sat on the sofa for 3 days because I couldn't move my knee. So I really had no idea how I would be. But I knew that it was the type of race that I wanted. I had so much fight and the weather conditions were just perfectly terrible. And so, yeah, I think the belief coming out of that race and then kind of getting a second place in Plouay, getting another stage win in the Giro, all of these things, It's like training. It's accumulation, isn't it, of all of these things. You accumulate miles in the bank, and you accumulate confidence in the bank as well, and you accumulate the belief that you can do it. And I think if you believe going into a race that you can be there, then the chances that you will be there just increase.
And Lizzie, this is my final question. What is it like going into a race when Richard Moore from the Cycling Podcast has picked you out as the favourite to win? That has got to be hard, right?
Did he say favourite to win? Sure.
He's definitely picked you out as his tip to win. That's what he says on that's what he says on our WhatsApp anyway.
Well, maybe he'd had a few too many glasses of wine if I know Richard. I wouldn't say that it piles the pressure on. It just makes me laugh, and that's definitely good for the soul. So, but I mean, I'm flattered, Richard, but I apologise in advance.
Well, Lizzie, honestly, I'm super excited to watch you. I thought it was thrilling last year. I mean, the great thing about last year when you were sixth was the look of suffering on your face. You know, you were... You were really fighting to hang in there, and I mean, there was no bluff going on whatsoever. I'll know how good your form is by the look on your face, I reckon.
But I think I always look like I'm trying really hard, even when I'm not trying really hard. I remember when I was off the front in a breakaway, and then looking on Twitter afterwards, and someone said, "Oh, she looks like she's really trying," and then Gabriel said, "Yeah, it's just what she looks like all the time." So yeah, maybe I'm double bluffing. Actually, I make it look like I'm really tired, but actually, I'm still super fresh.
Well, Lizzie, good luck. If you want to come for a ride with me online, you know I'm always here. In between, but honestly, no. I wish you all the luck. I'll look out for you at Strada and Omloop. I'm just really excited to see you in action, really. And we haven't even talked about Roubaix, so we'll talk about Roubaix next time out again, because you're on the list. So that, you know, you could have a cobble with your name on it in Roubaix. What about that? That's exciting.
Yeah, let's get these races out of the way first. And I don't think I can cope with the excitement of Roubaix when I'm this excited about Omloop already. So it's too much for one afternoon.